and welcome to our politics show here at the University of Reading. This week we have a jam-packed show in store for you where we'll be discussing the topic of sex and gender, looking specifically at the representation of women, men and the LGBT community in the media, how this affects gender stereotypes in society and leads to further problems, as well as gender transition issues and gender dysmorphia. Will and Philip delve into the Ukraine and Russia crisis following last week's invasion, including an excellent insight into this matter from one of our very own lecturers, whilst myself and Lisa discuss the recent safety measures which have been put in place around the university following the rise in spikings at the end of last year. We will also be asking people's opinions on the new Living with COVID scheme which came into action last week, as well as the Six Nations for the rugby fans out there. So stay tuned for an exciting show this week. But first, we have our daily news report with Philip and Lisa.
In international news, 40-mile-long Russian military convoys heading to Ukraine capital Kyiv as fears of an all-out assault on the city grow. In the meantime, there seems to be no progress or an agreement over a ceasefire between Ukraine and Russia during the first round of negotiations, which concluded earlier in the week. Representatives of Ukraine and Russia are meeting again on the Belarus border for the second round of negotiations which started yesterday, leaving some hope for change in the situation. All the while this is happening, the regular citizens of Ukraine take up arms, with President Zelensky spearheading the resistance against Russia, who has also asked Putin for one-to-one talks, having stated in a press conference, "We are not attacking Russia, and we do not plan to attack it. What do you want from us? Leave our land." During the State of the Union, US President Biden described the Ukrainian people as a wall of strength which Putin never anticipated, and President Zelensky as a person that inspires the world.
Since the beginning of Russia's invasion of Ukraine on February 24th, more than 115,000 refugees have crossed into Poland, the Polish Ministry of Internal Affairs said on Saturday. Anyone from Ukraine is allowed entry, even those who do not hold valid passports, the Polish official said. Priti Patel does not hold similar views. She refuses to waive all visa rules for Ukrainian refugees, sparking controversy among Britons. The Home Secretary cites concerns over extremist and Russian agents entering the UK amid growing unrest among the Tory MPs. At the same time, in a now-deleted tweet, Immigration Minister Kevin Foster has been criticised for suggesting those fleeing Russian forces apply to be fruit pickers in the UK.
In more national news, London is experiencing a three-day tube strike affecting thousands of people commuting to and from the capital. Andy Lord, TfL's chief operating officer, has said, "I would ask anyone who needs to use the tube on Thursday to check before they make their journey, consider whether they are able to work from home, and use alternative modes of transport where possible. If you are commuting from Reading to London, this is something to keep in mind."
Moving on to more uni internal news, RUSU elections are over. 2,114 students have voted for 56 candidates, casting a total of 14,067 votes. The new president is Sheldon Allen, Inclusion and Communities Officer Jem McKenzie, Welfare Officer is Poppy Lindsay, the Education Officer Oscar Minto, and Activities and Opportunities Officer is Harry Everett.
And finally, the news we've all been waiting for. In week 3 of the Six Nations Championship, the results are as follows. France beat Scotland with 36-17. Ireland beat Italy 57-6. England beat Wales 23-19. And in week 4, on Saturday the 12th of March at 4:44 p.m. at Twickenham, England is playing Ireland.
Those were the headlines for this week, and we will now move on to the ongoing problems with the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
On the 24th of February, just last week, what many experts feared may happen, happened, as Russia invaded its neighbouring country, Ukraine, after they announced their desire to join NATO. After weeks of unease in the west of Europe, after Russia sent troops to the eastern border of Ukraine, they eventually invaded. We spoke to lecturer of strategic studies here at the University of Reading, Kenton White, about the increasing tension and eventual invasion.
What are the main elements that characterise the Ukraine crisis?
The main elements that characterise the crisis are fear and the response to fear, but also a rose-tinted view of history and perhaps, from the West's perspective, an ignorance of the uncertainty that the Russians have about Western intentions. And it's the misunderstanding between East and West interpretation that has led us to this. There's the talk. the agreement not to expand NATO eastwards, never formalised, and the fear of newer NATO countries that used to be part of the Soviet Union. There's a fear there that they will be reoccupied or controlled by Russia. So both sides fear the other, and I think Ukraine is paying the price of that now.
In what sense is the Ukrainian crisis unique, and can it be compared to an event or it happened in the past?
I think every situation is unique, simply because you can't duplicate political problems or social problems or military problems. So in that respect, the situation in Ukraine is unique. The way it's occurred, let's call that the framework for bullying, for occupying another country, is not unique. It's been seen before. The obvious comparison would be 1938 with Czechoslovakia, but you could also compare it to the Russian suppression of Hungary in 1956, the invasion of Czechoslovakia in 1968, the Russian invasion of Afghanistan in 1979. I think it would be foolish to think that it's happening in a unique way. The circumstances are always different, but the method by which a country escalates a crisis is reasonably predictable.
The New York Times recently posted an article titled "In Ukraine Crisis, the Looming Threat of a New Cold War." What are your thoughts on this idea?
I think we have been in a cold war since about 2014. I don't think the situation should come as a surprise to Western leaders. The problem, I think, has been the naivety of the Western leaders in their dealings with Russia, with President Putin, assuming him to behave in a rational fashion. The original Cold War took a few years to ramp up, and I think we are now retrospectively quite comfortable in saying that we've seen the ramp. The ramp started around 2014, was fairly steep, and has just got steeper. So we are seeing not even the end game of the beginning of the new Cold War. What worries me more than anything is what will happen along the borders between NATO countries and how that will affect relations between NATO and the Russian Federation.
Vladimir Putin has recently stated that Russia is open to diplomacy. To what extent is a diplomatic or political solution a viable and realistic option for the crisis? And how should the West approach by diplomatic means?
The West has tried diplomacy, and so far Putin has said one thing and done another on each and every occasion. He has signed pieces of paper to respect the sovereignty of Ukraine, to respect the borders of Ukraine, and actions have not kept up with words. We should judge people by their actions. The only solution is the withdrawal of Russian troops, the withdrawal of Russian influence, and the re-establishment of a sovereign and democratic Ukraine, as it wants to be. You cannot negotiate that, because to negotiate, you have to have something to offer.
What does the Ukraine crisis and the Russian invasion mean for Britain now?
It will involve a refocus on policy directly into Europe, sadly from outside the EU, but still from within NATO, and all the previous attempts at cutting the armed forces, the defence budget, will have to be reversed if the situation continues to deteriorate the way it has done over the past 24 hours. As far as trade and economic sanctions go, it's going to hit Britain relatively hard, because there's a lot of Russian money in Britain, which will be frozen. I think we will see a polarisation of politics in this country, possibly even a return to hard left, hard right. We've seen soft left, medium right so far. We may see an increase in polarisation there too.
What is the worst case scenario outcome for the Ukraine crisis, and similarly, what's the best case outcome?
Okay, I'll start with the best case, which would be a complete withdrawal of Russian forces from Ukraine and also from the contested regions of East Ukraine, and the removal of the pro-Russian local governments in Luhansk and Donetsk. That's the best I can see. Vladimir Putin would order a withdrawal now, given the rhetoric that's been coming out of Moscow, is zero to nothing. That's not going to happen. The worst case scenario is that the invasion and occupation of Ukraine is one step on the way to the reoccupation of some or all of the Eastern European countries that were part of the USSR prior to the fall of the Soviet Union, in which case we are talking of a direct military confrontation between Russia and NATO. Any conventional conflict between NATO and Russia could very quickly escalate from conventional through tactical up to strategic nuclear exchange within a matter of days, even possibly hours. So the worst case scenario is nuclear war. The best case scenario isn't going to happen.
Obviously, this is an ever-changing situation, as it was only last week when Russia invaded, and already so much has happened. But I think this gives us a great insight into how the situation has escalated and the effects of this on the UK, EU, UN and NATO.
Moving on to a slightly different topic now, in this week's documentary, we explore the mis- and underrepresentation of women, men and LGBT communities in the media and the subsequent effects of this on gender stereotypes in society and gender representation in the workplace and politics. We researched society's view on sex and gender and used the work of experts to assess whether these stereotypes have been or are able to change.
When analysing this topic, it is important to note the differences between sex and gender, as they are often associated under the same general umbrella, but actually refer to very different things. Sex is a biological creature divided on the basis of a human's reproductive functions, whereas gender is socially and culturally constructed, so is much more open to interpretation. This phrase can have many connotations, but we related the two words to the effects which it has on today's society, concerning the advancement of media understanding, changes in attitudes, and effects on gender. During our research for this topic, we discovered that the underrepresentation of women and the LGBT community in the media has several effects, most of which are negative, which leads to significant gender stereotypes across society. There has been a huge academic and political interest in gender over the last few decades, which links closely to equality and diversity and the legal changes which have occurred. Human rights issues regarding equality of LGBTQ communities links to the normalisation of the sexual minorities and the importance of intersectionality. We have researched the change in recent years and how the presence of the media has affected stereotypes in society. We also explore the representation of men in the media and the gender gap and equality, as these are also subjects which hold significance in today's society. Generally, women are targeted and judged more by the media on their appearance and their family life than their male counterpart, particularly in politics. How many male politicians are questioned about their family? Women are significantly more likely to be asked about their family life than their ability to do something or the actual problem at hand and the reason as to why they are being interviewed. This is particularly noticeable when the media reports on female politicians, as it's their appearance which is depicted, and questions concerning family or home life are asked significantly more often than actual news on their policies. Kim Khan, Daphne Joanna van der Pas, and Loa Aldering are important scholars who have researched this matter in depth, and they all have emphasised the differences between the way women and men are treated in the media and the subsequent negative effect which it can have on a woman's career. However, despite their arguments, the media also targets men based on their appearance as well, suggesting that this is down to a change in the way the media works as opposed to being a gender problem. The media has recently developed a trend to comment on and mock male individuals' physical appearance as well, which has occurred due to a change in the nature of the media the last few decades. The media have heavily commented on the hair and general appearance of both Boris Johnson and Donald Trump, both of whom have significant media presence. This relates to the ever-changing nature of social media and how celebrities are used in memes and to create humour for an audience. The media in general have begun to scrutinise individuals in the limelight significantly more and not just provide the standard news. One of the main problems we discovered was that it appears to create a vicious circle, as the media's representation can subsequently affect the prospects of a woman's political career, which therefore leads to an underrepresentation of women in politics, causing less women to want to start a career in this sector. This then causes this industry to be a heavily male-dominated and masculine profession, so you can see how this affects the women's presence in certain sectors. Unfortunately, this appears to be present in many professions, such as construction, engineering, and science-related employment, as they are portrayed as masculine roles by the media, which discourages women from entering this field of employment. A study by Working Futures carried out in 2021 discovered that 99.19% of vehicle technicians, mechanics, and electricians were male, which is an astonishingly high percentage for this time period. The problem continues to remain like this due to the views of society which are imposed in the media. Stereotypes are extremely difficult to change. However, it should be noticed that the media often doesn't actually produce these stereotypes, but is instead seen to enforce them into society.
The often poor and unfair representation of women in the media and the focus on that side of the topic may lead us to assume that men are always portrayed very well and fairly, but this is unfortunately not the case. The rising effort around men's mental health by charities like Men's Health Forum and Mind has partially come from increased understanding about how men's portrayal in the media affects men. Men are far less researched in the political sphere because women are generally portrayed far more unfairly. As above, male politicians are generally questioned on their individual policy choices and views on issues. For example, where women may be asked how they will work alongside having a family. Outside of politics, is where men are generally represented dangerously by the media. In many films and television shows, for example, the protagonist is a male character. While this is partially an issue in terms of how women are represented for obvious reasons, it also creates a dangerous stereotype for men that they must be strong, aggressive, or even violent. Most men feel they should be able to protect others and portray these heroic actions as seen on screen. This may explain part of what toxic masculinity is, a phrase which is often brandished by those looking to blame individual men for certain problems, whether correct or not. Toxic masculinity is described as cultural norms that are associated with harm to society and men themselves. And the media is at the very least partially to blame for this. Jackson Katz argues that the epidemic of male violence is rooted in the media's inability to move away from the stereotype of what it means to be so-called a real man. Continuing on with that violent and aggressive stereotype. The idea of being financially stable also plays a big role in this, as the media often portrays the male lead as a provider and breadwinner. This obviously leads to men suffering from a financial struggle and a need for male individuals to work for both themselves and others to support others. This can lead to men feeling subpar to someone else because they may be reliant on another. The traditional media, i.e. films and television, are not the only form of media to blame, however, as the introduction of social media has made it very difficult for men to block out the stereotype that they may feel they need to become. An image is portrayed to them by a film, for example, and social media can then reinforce that stereotype to any man with seemingly never-ending examples to show them what they are not. This returns us to the theme of toxic masculinity. Men begin to try so hard to match this unrealistic portrayal of a man on social media that they turn to the only supposedly manly characteristic they can attain instantly, aggression. A study composed by Innovation Unit in 2020, looking into young male adults in Greater Manchester, explains that while pressure to be a man is not new, it is now more intense than ever. Young men are no longer able to let their guard down, as the report states. They are instead encouraged to continuously perform the hard man role and furthermore recreate on social media to create a so-called masculine image plagued with violence and aggression. This continues the cycle, adding more toxic masculinity to social media for the next young man to see and likely copy, proceeding the issue further and further. The important thing to look at is the effect of all this on the modern man, for some worrying statistics. For example, 3 times more men die from suicide than women, and those aged 40 to 49 are most at risk. This demographic may be evidence of the social media aspect affecting more than just young male individuals.
and is certainly an indicator of how poor the situation for men's mental health is. Furthermore, we can see how toxic masculinity has affected men by looking into prison statistics, with 75,000 men in prison to just 3,200 women in 2021. While these are obviously not all necessarily violent crimes, it is still a fair indicator of how men are affected by this gender stereotype and how negative the situation can be. Similarly, it is difficult to see exactly how big a role in this situation media plays, be it social media or more traditional forms, but nearly two-thirds, or 64%, of UK males aged 18 to 34 think negative male representation in advertising does real psychological damage, according to a study by Net Imperative in February 2021. This means that while it may be difficult to quantify, it is clear that the media plays a role in this epidemic of struggling men, and most men do understand this. It isn't all negative, however. Times are beginning to change and more is being done to assist with men's mental health, such as more and more fundraising and awareness around the issues. Many of these men's mental health charities have become household names, and many more people are discussing and understanding the issue. The Samaritans tell us that there were 4,912 suicides registered in 2020, 404 fewer than in 2019, and that prison numbers are also dropping. This is evidence of exceptional and hard work being done, and while more needs to continue to happen, it is a promising sign. But if the media is such a big contributor to this problem, what is being done about it? In terms of social media, many influencers are getting more involved and continuing to spread awareness around the issue. For example, Dr. Alex, who has amassed 2 million followers at the time of recording, has a weekly podcast named The Waiting Room, in which he openly discusses mental health. People like Dr. Alex are excellent at providing help and guidance, particularly to a younger audience, about their own mental health and the struggles of being a man. In terms of more traditional media, less is being done directly. Women are now given more starring roles as the more aggressive and frankly significant characters in TV shows and films, but the lines many of these studios take are based around gender equality for women. While this is still excellent and a huge part of our vastly changing world, it does not directly take into account how traditional media affects the lives of men and what could be done to change it. So after all of this, concerning the image of both males and females which is portrayed in the media, is this really a gender issue, or is this a problem with today's role and presence of the media?
Following on from this, we discovered that the representation of the LGBT community in the media has slightly different immediate effects than that of men and women. Historically, the portrayals of LGBT individuals have been severely negative, which reflects the cultural intolerance of this sector of society. However, from the 1990s onwards, this cultural feeling and representation of the LGBT community in the media began to change, becoming less tolerant of negative opinions, portraying them in a much more positive light. However, it is important to stress that this was not an easy process, as there have been several movements and protests to support the LGBT community, including them defending themselves from hate and discrimination, aiming to increase their presence in the media. Attitudes towards this have changed over time, and a more positive portrayal and increased presence of the LGBT individuals in the media has helped to increase acceptance and support for the community, establish it as a norm, and provide information on the topic. Despite the more positive coverage, the general representation of these groups in the media has caused stereotypes to be formed within society. Gay men are seen as feminine and flamboyant, whilst lesbians are often seen as masculine and somewhat out of touch with their female gender. Human rights campaigner Peter Tatchell stated that gay men are less fully masculinized than heterosexual men, and others believe that the media is somewhat to blame for this due to the high presence of this in films, books, TV shows, and magazines. Whilst obviously this is not the case in every situation, the general view of this has been present for some time and makes the stereotype somewhat entrenched into society. In addition to this, the media has only very recently begun to include bisexual and transgender individuals into the media, as before they were often simply ignored. There is also significantly less representation of non-binary or gender fluid individuals in the media, and only very recently have Facebook even given an alternative to being male or a female. This is something which we expect to see a change of in the near future, like how the attitudes of homosexual individuals have become significantly more accepted. The thought is that views of non-binary and gender fluid individuals will follow this trend. Media depictions have both benefited and disadvantaged the LGBT community. Significant milestones have occurred regarding celebrities and their sexuality, from the likes of Ellen DeGeneres, Ruby Rose, and Miley Cyrus. This has had a huge impact on teenagers and adults today, as they encouraged other people to come out and feel comfortable in their skin and with their sexuality. This ongoing problem, which remains in our society, is closely related to how we view sex and gender. Sociologists and many psychologists believe our gender is our socially constructed status as men, masculine, or women, feminine. The degree of maleness and femaleness will vary according to chromosomal and hormonal factors. The degree of masculinity and femininity will vary according to sociocultural variables, such as a person's social class, age, ethnicity, interpersonal relationships, self-esteem, and social identity, etc. Constructionists such as Delphi have suggested that divisions between male and female, sex and gender, are symbolic and political and socially contingent. Removing these social constraints and stereotypes from society would be extremely difficult, if not impossible, which is why there has been a huge academic and political interest in this topic over the last few decades.
This part of the documentary is going to look at gender dysphoria and transgenderism. In order to better understand and grasp the information provided, we will begin by first addressing and clarifying the terminology used throughout, as well as giving definitions for specific terms, considering that this is a topic which is difficult to understand from an outside point of view of people that have not dealt with these issues personally. We will simultaneously showcase examples of the issues trans people face and the solutions for them which only fully work in theory. As such, we will begin by asking the question, what is gender dysphoria? According to the American Psychiatric Association, it is psychological distress that results from an incongruence between one's sex assigned at birth and one's gender identity. Keeping in mind the aforementioned definition of gender dysphoria, we can begin to understand a part of what the term transgender means. It refers to a person whose sex assigned at birth, usually based on external genitalia, does not match their gender identity, i.e. one's psychological sense of their gender. According to the NHS, the number of people being referred and diagnosed with the condition has increased a lot over the last decade. In 2018-19, around 8,000 people were referred to adult gender dysphoria services in England. However, the question now exists, what is the link between gender dysphoria and transgenderism? Does gender dysphoria necessarily have to lead to a person becoming transgender? In discovering this, according to an Age UK fact sheet from 2021, the first step is assessment, beginning with a visit to the GP, which notably mentions, most GPs are unlikely to have seen many, if any, trans people, and may not have experience of trans issues. They are then referred to a specialist team at an NHS gender dysphoria clinic. A diagnosis is made after an in-depth assessment by two or more specialists involving multiple sessions, months apart. However, despite this seeming like a viable option in theory, a paper published by the Equality and Human Rights Commission claims that trans people experience a range of barriers in accessing NHS gender reassignment services, from referral by GPs to treatment by clinicians. Evidence from England suggests further problems, including a lack of knowledge on the part of GPs on referring patients to gender identity services, or, at worst, GPs allegedly being obstructive or discriminatory. A study of 382 trans people in the UK and Ireland found that even within gender identity clinics, 62% of trans people had experienced negative questions, attitudes, or services. Based on the assessment, according to the NHS, the treatment can vary, and this can mean different things to different people. For some, the treatment may just involve acceptance and affirmation or confirmation of their identity.
For others, it may involve bigger changes, such as changes to their voice, hormone treatment, or surgery. An important statistic released by the American College of Pediatricians mentions that 80% to 95% of children with gender dysphoria accepted their biological sex by late adolescence, meaning they experienced some form of resolution if they were not exposed to social affirmation or medical intervention. For people that do not experience resolution and are diagnosed with a level of gender dysphoria that warrants a more drastic change, the reality can be different. A diagnosis of gender dysphoria in the UK allows access to cross-sex hormones from the age of 16 and surgery from the age of 18, according to a Government Equalities Office paper published in 2018. According to which, there is no robust data on the UK trans population and the amount of trans people in the country. The world today is becoming more progressive, tolerant and accommodating, though that wasn't always the case, which means that some social structures have to undergo changes and restructuring in some instances in order to account for and keep up with the world of today. The domain of law is one example of that. As late as 2004, the Gender Recognition Act came into force, which enabled trans people to change their legal gender subject to meeting the requirements of that act. Since it has come into force, approximately 4,900 trans people have been issued a gender recognition certificate. Furthermore, gender reassignment is a protected characteristic under the Equality Act of 2010. The Act prohibits unlawful discrimination, harassment, and victimisation, protects individuals from unfair treatment, and promotes a fair and more equal society. It protects transgender people from being discriminated against in a variety of fields, including employment, education, the exercise of public functions, and the provision of services. Again, despite these solutions to some of these issues which trans people face existing, they only fully work in theory. A trans report published by Stonewall in 2018 titled LGBT in Britain, which in their words exposes the profound impact that discrimination, violence and exclusion is having on trans people's quality of life in Britain today, suggests that 2 in 5 trans people, which amounts to 41%, have experienced a hate crime or incident because of their gender identity in the past 12 months, and more than a quarter of trans people in a relationship have experienced domestic abuse from a partner. Research from Ipsos carried out online among British adults aged 18 to 75 finds that 70% of Britons believe that transgender people face discrimination, with a quarter saying they face a great deal. To round off this part of the documentary, it is safe to say that although steps are being taken in order to address the issues trans people face, we are not fully at a point where a trans person can navigate as easily through life and society as a non-trans person.
Lastly, I will look at the gender gap and the benefits of gender diversity. We have talked a lot about stereotypes and their representation in the media. However, this type of bias is not only limited to the media world. It is also very prominent in other parts of society, which is why I took a look at the gender gap. According to the Economic Forum, or WE Forum, the gender gap refers to differences between men and women as shown in social, political, intellectual, cultural, or economic achievements or attitudes, such as, for example, representation in politics, access to and level of education, and the difference in salaries, leadership, representation, and more when it comes to economic gender gap. The WE Forum has used the Global Gender Index, which measures the gap in areas of health, education, politics, and economics, to rank 144 countries on the gender gap. The country with the smallest gender gap is Iceland, followed by the other Scandinavian countries, as well as Rwanda in fourth place, just ahead of Sweden. It is notable that all Scandinavian countries are represented in the top 5 of this list. The United Kingdom is ranked 15th, which is close to the front. The Gender Gap Index found that there was virtually no gap in education and health criteria. However, both economy and especially politics are lacking female representation in the UK. The same pattern can be seen in a lot of other countries. At the end of the list, we find countries with the biggest gender gaps, which are Yemen, Pakistan and Syria. Overall, the Middle East and Northern African countries rank lowest compared to other regions, which comes to little surprise given that most of these countries have limiting laws as well as societal norms compared to the societal structure of Western countries. Because the gender gap is a very broad topic to cover, I took a closer look at the economic aspect of the gender gap, as we see it, for example, in the labor force. The traditional stereotypes of the man being the breadwinner, being the main source of income, and the woman becoming a stay-at-home mom, being dependent on the man, have largely been abandoned throughout the years, especially in the westernized world. However, a lot of Middle Eastern countries still enforce the strong distinction between the male and female work responsibilities. According to 2017 International Labour Organization's findings, the current global labour force participation rate for women is just under 47%. For men, it's 72%. There's a large difference of 25%, with some regions even facing a gap of 50 percentage points. Again, these countries are likely to be located in the Middle East. Yemen, for example, has a gap of 61.6%, showing one of the biggest gaps in labour force participation. The United Kingdom, however, has a gap of 9.1%, which is very similar to other European countries. Most surprisingly, there are three countries that have a small negative gender gap, meaning they have slightly higher female labour force participation. These countries are Sierra Leone, Burundi, and Rwanda. Notably, all those three countries are located in Africa. In moving forward in closing the gender gap, it is important to learn from these countries and their achievements. However, while it is remarkable, it is important to keep in mind that the vast majority of countries are still struggling to close the gender gap. Looking more closely at how women actually spend their time compared to men, in general, women are likely to work fewer paid hours than men. But on average, they also spend more than three times as much time doing unpaid work, such as household chores and family care. When summarized, women are likely to work even longer hours than men. When asked and Gallup in 2016, 70% of women said they would prefer paid work over family doing both. While many have their reasons why they do not, it is telling that most do want to work paid jobs rather than be a family caretaker. Moving on to how such equal representation can improve society and especially business. While gender equality is still a long way away from being reality, there are some great benefits in gender diversity. Firstly, companies can greatly benefit from promoting a gender diverse workplace. Research by Gallup from 2014 found that gender diverse businesses generate more income. For example, retail companies have on average generated 14% more revenue if gender diverse than those that were not. For hospitality companies, it was 19%. Gallup finds that gender diverse and engaged business units outperform those that are less diverse and less engaged. They also argue that men and women have different perspectives that can lead to better choice making and problem solving, thus benefiting the business by making smarter decisions. We can also observe similar effects in politics. The 2017 report by the World Economic Forum suggests that economic gender equality could add up to $250 billion to the UK's GDP, similarly $1,750 billion to that of the United States, an additional $2.5 trillion to the GDP of China. These are significant numbers that could greatly benefit those economies. These findings show that countries should generally push more towards gender diversity in the workforce in order to generate more economic growth. Apart from the economic benefit, having a diverse government helps accurately represent society. The European Institute for Gender Equality found that equal representation of men and women can create fair societies as well as higher the standard of living, make positive developments in education, health and infrastructure, and also decrease corruption in politics. The UN has also observed similar effects in peacekeeping. UN peacekeeping missions are said to be more effective if the team sent out is built in a gender-diverse way. According to the UN, more women in peacekeeping means more effective peacekeeping. Women peacekeepers improve peacekeeping performance, have greater access to communities, help in promoting human rights and the protection of civilians, and encourage women to become a meaningful part of peace and the political process. In general, it can be seen that diversity has overall positive effects, which is why it should be further encouraged by both companies and governments. Having discussed gender stereotypes and representation in the media, gender dysphoria and transgender, lastly gender gap, we hope to have given you a diverse understanding of sex and gender as well as something to think about for the future.
Following on from our documentary, we now have another interview of RUSU's welfare representative Grace Loweth, where we discuss last year's sharp rise in spiking cases across the UK and how RUSU have responded to this to keep our campus a safe place. For reference, a government poll looking into spiking in the UK found that 1 in 9 women and 1 in 17 men said that they had been spiked in the past. Grace gives us a great insight into what has been done to prevent this from occurring.
So I'm Grace Loweth, I'm RUSU Welfare Officer. So I'm one of the 4 elected full-time officer positions here at the Students' Union. I was elected literally this time, like last week, a year ago. And I work at the Student Union for a year to work on my own manifesto points and to reinforce the students in there and improve their student experience, particularly in regards to mental health, safety on campus, the community, and also accommodation.
After the spiking outbreak at the end of last year, what measures have RUSU taken to attempt to prevent this from occurring and continuing in the future?
So one of the first things we did was we held a student forum where any students could come and talk to us about any concerns they had or wanted, any sort of issues that they have had arise during the venue, so we could make sure that that was incorporated in what we do to improve the measures. And we had the police, so Thames Valley Police, we had the Girls Night In campaign themselves come, our women's part-time officer, we had campus security come as well, and it was just an opportunity for any students to ask any questions they want. So that was one of the things. We then worked with Thames Valley Police, and our venue team went to the like local pub watch, which is a group of all of the pubs in like town and all of the venues, so it'll be like Q Club and stuff as well. And they made them aware of the situation, said like, this is what we're doing. And the police also recommended that as a minimum every 1 in 3 students would be searched, rather than a spot check, to just do every 1 in 3, and that's what we do as a minimum. So when we can we do every student, so they'll get a pat down, bags will be searched, they have IDs and campus cards checked. I think we also have like a scanner for IDs and stuff now. We also provided spikies, which go in like the top of a bottle, like a VK, which makes you not be able to put anything in it. And we have lids on order as well as spiking testing kits from a supplier, but they've been very, very busy, so we've not been able to get any until now. And we also have been working with like the student welfare team at the university. We've created spiking little like business cards, so we inform students what to do if you've been spiked, and the hope is that everyone will end up with one of these like in their wallet, so either for them or a friend, they'll know what to do as immediate action. And we also have posters in the venue about as well, to just sort of help reinforce the message that we don't stand for it and we are there to support the students.
Obviously, those are a lot of measures. In general, have they been successful?
I think to a degree, definitely the searching. I think our venue team have said that students have turned away in the queue when they've seen that people are being searched, which I think, although we're not necessarily catching them, whatever they have with them, it might not be something to do with spiking, but they're turning away. That sort of helps reinforce that we won't stand for that. So that's been very useful. And I think also the fact that we've worked with the Girls Night In campaign themselves to say that we really care, we want to continue to do stuff. They've sort of said to us, yeah, this is the right thing to do, do this, this will be useful. I think that has helped us understand that some of the stuff has been successful, but then there's always more you can do. We're not a nightclub that only opens at the night, we're a venue in the day. If people are really desperate to do stuff, they can bring stuff in the day. And we can't stop that because we can't search everyone anytime anyone comes into the building, unfortunately.
So that links on to the next question, just about like problems which you faced, like implementing these measures and with like results and stuff. Was there anything that you came across in particular?
I think one of the things that came up for us was that on social media, we tried to put some stuff out We were, to be completely honest, we were slightly late. We had it ready the night before to go, to help sort of, before a union happened, to help students like feel confident to come to the venue. But we couldn't put it out straight away because we needed to get it checked and stuff. And on social media, students were very, you know, completely understand why, very vocal. But then when we gave them the opportunity to come and talk to us about the concerns they had, it was very difficult to get engagement. We had all of the great people there to talk to them. Some students did come, but they're very engaged and not typically the type of students who will come to every union night anyway. Mm-hmm. So the impact on them personally is quite minimal. And so that was something that was, I guess, quite difficult to implement. And also the fact that with the way that spiking and like people getting spiked works is that the like if you go to A&E, they're very unlikely to test you, which then makes it very difficult to understand the actual situation because you have people who are drunk, who don't understand what happened, someone who's potentially been spiked, but then we can never say if they've been spiked or not. That was a very big issue that I think we still have now. Like they still, the A&E still won't test people if they've been spiked. It has to come to the police.
Has there been any feedback from students, from security, just in general with the measures?
Yeah, so I think particularly, so we worked very closely with the Girls Night In campaign themselves, as we wanted to make sure that we didn't feel like we'd palmed them off. So we worked very closely with them and they were very supportive on the measures that we suggested that we could put in place. Obviously some things we do have to be quite realistic. If it's a sellout night, we're not going to be able to search everyone unless everyone stands outside for like 4 hours, which people will just not enjoy. Particularly the Girls Not In campaign and our part-time officers and students that I have spoken to have said that we've done a lot in regards to that, you know, we've really tried to help. And we keep trying to put the message across to Pub Watch, so the venues in town, like, do the same as what we've done. But obviously we can't make them do it, but we hope that we always sort of lead by example on that front. So I think that the feedback so far has been quite positive.
Do you think that nightclubs in general need to do more to protect their customers? Obviously Rusu seem to be going like above and beyond what generally nightclubs seem to be doing, so do you think it should be like used more?
Yeah, 100%. I think it's really difficult for venues when they don't have the student, like we're the students union and we have a venue. Like it's not that we're a venue at first and foremost, like our main priority is to improve and look after the students and their experience here. Venues in town all across the country who aren't student unions are not going to care as much because their main purpose is to make a profit and to sort of get the punters in, and that's their purpose. Their purpose isn't to campaign for student rights and stuff. So I think something to help like reinforce what we're doing to make that more, but to make it a more sort of level playing field. So as like a fresh 18-year-old, you know what the support you would expect to get at any venue, regardless of whether or not it's a student union nightclub or not. I think that would be like dream case.
That gave us a great insight into how the university is working with institutions like Girls Night In and the Thames Valley Police to protect our students from spiking, and also information on how to deal with and what to do if you find yourself in that situation. Despite this happening mostly in the last few months of the last year, unfortunately it will remain an issue for the foreseeable future. But I think it's really reassuring to see how much Rusu and the welfare team are doing to prevent it from happening as much as they can and support us as students.
We now move on to the last part of our broadcast, starting off with a quick discussion of the new COVID policy. Last week, the government announced a living with COVID plan for the future of the pandemic, where self-isolating has become non-compulsory. Boris Johnson announced that despite these new relaxed measures, people should still be sensible and cautious with their actions. However, this puts us in a very grey area as it leaves little judgment, the judgment down to the individual's opinions as to what is responsible and safe if you test positive for COVID. In response to this, politicians have argued that we cannot live in restrictions forever and enough damage has been done to the economy already. And this is important for the recovery of the UK. What do you guys think, and how will this change our daily lives?
I think that this needs to have been done for the world to return to some sort of normality. We can't be living in and out of lockdown restrictions forever. And personally, I have had it, and if I didn't test, I wouldn't have even realised, as I didn't feel ill. So I think it's a really good thing getting things back to normal.
Yeah, I agree with that. Like Gabby said, we can't live with restrictions forever, and this will benefit our economy hugely. But I think it's so deep into society that people will still feel guilty when they go out with COVID. So that's something we can get used to.
I also think it was necessary. At some point, COVID has to become similar to the flu where we get a jab every year. However, I feel like it's getting very uncontrollable with this abandoning of all rules, thus making it quite difficult for those that are vulnerable in our society.
I think it's particularly interesting how the media has switched their focus from COVID to Ukraine. Would COVID coverage have been different if the Ukraine invasion never happened? And has Boris used this switch in media attention to slip under the radar in regards to his party scandal? These are all thought-provoking questions.
There has been a record increase in global gas prices, which will come into action from April this year. It sees energy price cap rise by 54%, which is an astonishing percentage. This will affect around 22 million customers across the UK, but does affect customers differently. Those on default tariffs paying direct debit will see an increase of £693 per year, whilst prepaying customers will see an increase of £708. This is definitely something to look out for, as it will affect many students living in rented housing. The increase has been driven by a record rise in global gas prices over the last 6 months, with wholesale prices quadrupling in the last year. This price cap is updated twice a year and allows energy companies to pass on costs to customers. Since the price cap was last updated in August, the current level does not reflect the unprecedented record rise in gas prices which has since taken place. This explains why the increase is occurring in April, so it's important for us to look out for these rises and budget accordingly.
In the sporting world, the Six Nations are continuing next weekend with matches between Wales and France, Italy and Scotland, and Ireland and England. Currently, France are at the top of the table with 3 wins from 3, whilst Ireland and England are respectively in second and third with 2 wins and a loss. Next weekend's game between England and Ireland is a big one, and for the Welsh students out there, they've got a tricky match ahead of them, playing the current leaders of France. Gabby, how do you think England will get on?
Well, I will be rooting for England, but I think it will be quite an exciting and close game, so I'm really looking forward to it.
There was also a huge win for Reading Bucks Rowing Society up in Newcastle last week, but while most other sporting societies are coming to the end of their season in the coming weeks, we prepare for Varsity on the 26th of March, a huge day for the university where we face our arch rivals, Oxford Brookes. Keep the date free for a fun-filled day packed with Reading's finest athletes.
And unfortunately, that is all that we have time for on this week's episode of The Politics Show, where we discuss how the 21st century's media is affecting gender stereotypes and whether this is expected to change in the near future, along with an excellent insight into the Ukraine crisis with Kenton White. The Rusu Welfare Officer gave some great information about keeping our campus a safe and secure place where students can relax and have fun, and a brief discussion of living with COVID and Six Nations. Before we close off completely, we'd like to say happy birthday to Gabby, one of our presenters here. Happy birthday, Gabby.
Thanks.
We'd like to say a big thank you as well to our listeners for listening and tuning in this week, and we hope you found it interesting. So it's goodbye from us here at the studio, from Gabby, Lisa, Will, and me, Philip, and we look forward to seeing you all again next week.